Okay, so I would like you to imagine just a little bit. I want you to imagine a king sitting on his throne, okay? And I want you to imagine a king who is in the midst of all his pomp, right? All of his glory and majesty. You can imagine maybe it's his coronation. And we're going to think a little bit. So I actually would like you to close your eyes if you need to, but I'd like you to be specific, right? You can, maybe if it helps, think of a king from medieval Europe. That's kind of what we're most familiar with, probably. So think about what are the things that you see there that reflect his glory. When we say picture a king in glory and splendor, what sorts of things do you see?
A crown.
A throne.
A throne,
right. The robes. Let me read to you what I had written ahead of time, right? Because you're nailing it, okay? Right? It says, there's a crown on his head, right? A scepter, or maybe a sword in his hand. The throne itself is large, right? Probably raised up on like a dais, right? To visibly convey that he is above everybody else. The throne is made out of gold, right? Maybe with all kinds of intricate carving with ivory and gems inlaid, right? He's wearing expensive robes of silk, trimmed with the most expensive furs, the ones that, like, by law, no one else is allowed to wear, right? Everything around him, there's not a thing in sight that is not the best of its kind, right? Tapestries from Persia, from rugs from Persia, tapestries from Egypt, vases from the Orient, right? Wherever your eye falls, you're blown away and reminded that you are in the house of someone who is not like you, that before you is not someone just like everybody else. Now, how can we make that picture even more impressive? Right now, we've been real zoomed in on the king, but now we're going to step back, and we notice the king is not alone, right? He's surrounded by others. You have all the chief ministers on one side, people with those fancy titles like vizier, or however that's pronounced, right? On the other side, you have cardinals and bishops, and they're all in front of an enormous audience chamber. Right, filled with long rows of noblemen and noblewomen. They stand behind ranks of knights in glittering armor, decked out with colorful silks, all of them standing at perfect attention, each one of them, again, a visible embodiment of the power of the king. And surrounded by so much glory, the king appears even more glorious. But the thing is that none of these people bring their glory to add to the king. Because every single one of these counselors and noblemen and soldiers owes their position to the king. He is the one that has appointed each one of them. He is the one that made him a general, made him a minister, made him a cardinal. And it's interesting how that works. Their glory is something they've received from the king. Like all those noblemen. They have an estate somewhere because the king granted it to them. Their glory is something they've received from him. And by receiving glory from him, they actually complement, add to, and fill out his glory. They elevate his glory. So the king heightens his own glory by bringing others into it. But there's still one thing missing. What is the one thing, even in royal life today, that can rival the pomp and glory of a coronation? What? How about a royal wedding? There, bingo, bonus prize. We have chocolate left over from Father's Day, and you can take all of it. A royal wedding. As you try to picture a king in maximal glory, the crown jewel among all the other crown jewels is the queen at his side. The most beautiful and worthy woman you've ever seen, arrayed in pearls and diamonds, brocaded silks, splendor that surpasses everything else in the room, even the king. Who wants to look at the king? Right? And yet, like all the others in the room, she actually has no glory except what she has been elevated to by the king. Right? He is the one that made her queen. He is the one that raised her to the throne. He is the one that provided all of that rich adornment that she carries so well. And again, by bestowing his glory on her, his own glory is made more visible. Right? Making her glorious, he brings his own glory to a greater perfection. So today we're going to look at Psalm 45, which describes a royal wedding. And we're not told exactly whose, right? We don't have a big, long historical prelude to the psalm. But Solomon's marriage to a royal princess from Egypt, which was the most important of his many marriages, is a really pretty good guess. You know, we have nothing to go on, but if you have to pick something, then it would probably be Solomon's marriage to the daughter of Pharaoh. So, here is Psalm 45. First, the introduction. An unusual one in the book of Psalms. It stands out. My heart is stirred by a noble theme. As I recite my verses for the king, my tongue is the pen of a skillful writer. And then he begins by praising the king. You are the most excellent of men, and your lips have been anointed with grace, since God has blessed you forever. Essentially, what it's saying is that the king is a personal favorite with God. And as we've seen in the other Psalms, right, the reason is not some arbitrary favoritism, right? All through these kingship Psalms, we've been seeing that God favors this king. This king has God's goodwill because in him, God has found someone after his own heart. Someone who only wants what he wants. Someone who is wholly surrendered and yielded in his heart to God. That's why this king is the most excellent of men. Gird your sword upon your side, O mighty one. Clothe yourself with splendor and majesty. In your majesty, ride forth victoriously in behalf of truth, humility, and righteousness. Let your right hand display awesome deeds. Let your sharp arrows pierce the hearts of the king's enemies. Let the nations fall beneath your feet. Wherever the king goes, he sees victory. And again, this is one of these themes that we've seen come back again and again. And the reason here, as in the other Psalms, again, the reason that he always sees victory is that he only fights God's cause. He only goes out in the name of truth and righteousness. And funny that humility is stuck in there. That's the humility of only fighting God's causes. The king does not stand up for himself, right? And David is a good example of that. When people would attack David personally, he wouldn't defend himself. If they attacked the kingdom, if they attacked God's interests, if they attacked God's people, David was the worst of enemies. But when he was attacked himself, that was with God, right? The humility of being wholly surrendered to God. Despite his power and glory, he serves God's interests. And the beauty of this king is first and foremost, as we see what the author is talking about, a moral beauty. The beauty that arises from justice and mercy. Your throne, O God, will last forever and ever. A scepter of justice will be the scepter of your kingdom. Though you love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has set you above your companions by anointing you with the oil of joy. And again, we have here the assertion that the foundation of this king's success is justice, right? Equipped with God's wisdom, he is able to not just to do what seems right, which is the best that most of us can aspire to, but he does what is right. And so God blesses his reign. Now notice, interestingly, verse 6 there, the author says, "Your throne, O God," okay? And it's possible that for just this one line, the author turns his attention from addressing the king to addressing God. But there's actually a more likely explanation, and that's the possibility that the poet addresses the king as God, okay? And in all the cultures around Israel, that was very normal, right? Kings were seen as a kind of an actual embodiment of the god, and which later became the king, actually like becomes a god. But that's unheard of in the Old Testament, right? In the Old Testament, in Israel, we have a very clear delineation between God and everything but God, including the king. But even with that clear understanding that was in Israel, language is still language. And even in the Old Testament, we have the word God, Elohim, being used not only of God, but of gods, and also of angels as divine beings, and also of kings and powerful people, like judges, in the idea that they exercise a power that is godlike. Okay? So there's most likely, this is a figurative use of God, referring still to the king. Then the poet's description moves from the glory of past battles, right? And we've seen through these kingship psalms that there's the story is after a king is put on the throne, the first thing he has to do is go out to fight battles to establish his kingdom. We move from the glory of those past battles to the greater glory of a present peace and the celebration of this wedding. He says, continuing to address the king, "All your robes are fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. From palaces adorned with ivory, the music of the strings makes you glad. Daughters of kings are among your honored women. At your right hand is the royal bride in gold of Ophir." The glory of the king is reflected and heightened by the glory of all the people who have gathered around to celebrate. Celebrate him, celebrate his kingdom, celebrate his victory that has established his kingdom, and to celebrate the wedding. And with that reference to the royal bride, right, he's described the king so far, and it finished with a reference to his bride. So now the poet turns his attention to the queen. And we have a description of the queen and an address to her, as she stands there in robes woven with threads of gold, right? This bride queen would be newly arrived from a foreign nation, okay? This is how it worked in the ancient world. And it's probably not accidental that this is happening after the king has won these battles, right? After you establish your throne, that's when you have the position of honor that other kings want to make alliances with you. And the exchanging brides would be a way of sealing that alliance. Okay, so this queen would actually probably be one of many princesses in her home kingdom. Actually, this kind of can sound a little awful, but you know, the king, say, of Egypt would have had a lot of daughters, and what they're there for is to marry them off and make alliances, right? They're capital, you could say. So this bride queen is probably in her teens. She has not been, you know, close to her father. She hasn't been the one of his two daughters, right? Like nowadays we would have to his daughter. She's probably lived most of her life in the women's quarters with a whole bunch of other women who are her peers. And there's, you know what happens, you get a couple dozen women together, and I mean, men are no different, we just do it differently, right? Right? No, but in all seriousness, there'd be a fair amount of rivalry, right? Who's going to be married off to who? Who's going to be still here in dad's house in 30 years, right? And who's going to be shuffled off to some minor kingdom out in Anatolia somewhere and disappear from the pages of history? Who might get sent to Babylon? Right? So she would be newly arrived from a foreign nation, and so the poet advises her to appreciate the honor that has been given to her by wholeheartedly embracing her new life instead of mourning or pining for all that she must have left behind. He says, "Listen, O daughter, consider and give ear. Forget your people and your father's house. The king is enthralled by your beauty. Honor him, for he is your lord." Now, the NIV doesn't choose to bring it out, but most likely the sense, the connection between two of those lines is forget your father's house, and thereby, and so, the king will desire your beauty. Okay? Imagine being the king, marrying this princess, making her queen, elevating her to this position of power and honor, and she mopes around, complaining about this and that and this stupid backwater kingdom in Canaan. And who eats this stuff anyway? Right? It's not going to endear her to the king. And certainly it's not going to make life any easier for her. She's not going back. Although, in ancient history, there are a couple examples of that. There's a big deal. Going back, there's no solution to anything. So a great example of what the poet would be talking about is Queen Puduhepa. Anyone ever heard of Puduhepa? She was a queen of the Hittite Empire. The Hittites are, you kind of hear about them every now and then, but people don't know much about them. It's in modern day what's now Turkey. And in the older part of the Old Testament, like the time of Joshua and Judges back then, they were actually one of the major world powers, rivaling Mesopotamia and Egypt. So anyways, Queen Puduhepa lived during around the time of Joshua or the Judges, and she was the daughter of a minor neighboring kingdom, right? You kind of have the big kings, and then you have lots of little kings who kind of change teams every now and then. So she was the daughter of one of these minor kings who was married to a Hittite general who then became the Hittite emperor, Mattusili III. And she completely devoted herself to her new people. She completely devoted herself to Mattusili. Okay? And she became one of the most successful and important diplomats of the entire ancient world. Okay? She's actually gone down in history more than almost any of the Hittite emperors themselves, because she so wholeheartedly embraced her new position. And interestingly, history tells us that they had a wonderful marriage, that they really genuinely loved one another and were devoted to one another, which is actually very, very unusual. I think in actual fact, it wasn't all that unusual, because people are people and, you know, love happens. But the fact that it's recorded in history is actually very, very unusual. Then he continues, "The daughter of Tyre will come with a gift. Men of wealth will seek your favor." This is still addressed to the queen. "Will seek your favor. All glorious is the princess within her chamber. Her gown is interwoven with gold. In embroidered garments, she's led to the king. Her virgin companions, right, her young maidens, follow her and are brought to you. They are led in with joy and gladness. They enter the palace of the king," right, for the wedding celebration. This is describing just the privileges and the honor that she now has as queen. All those other princesses former peers and rivals, they now seek her favor. They come with gifts. She lives in splendor and is surrounded by young companions, the daughters of all the nobility, who follow with her in a joyous parade up to the palace for the wedding. And then the poet again addresses the king, but the message is very much for both the king and the queen. And the point is that this is not the end of previous life. This is the beginning of something new that will be far greater than the past. And the way that that is poetically said is your sons will take the place of your fathers. The future is greater than the past. Your sons will take the place of your fathers. You will make them princes throughout the land. I will perpetuate your memory through all generations. Therefore, the nations will praise you forever and ever. The future is what she needs to live for, what they need to live for. The king and the queen are promised that they will be given sons who will fill their hearts with joy as they grow up to share in their reign. Now, as we think about this psalm as one that is messianic in some sense, there are two things that I want to pull out and think about. First is the language that's used to describe the king, right? It is exaggerated. This is the normal hyperbole, right, or exaggeration that you always find in poetry and that you always find when talking to powerful people, right? The king is pictured more beautiful, more virtuous, and more just than he probably was. Okay? But as we've seen in all of these psalms that we've looked at, the exaggerated language then goes so beyond the level of exaggeration that we would actually expect and see in other ancient addresses to like kings and royalty. It goes so far beyond what could actually be said of a king that you begin to get the sense that maybe there's more to it. Right? If Jesus had only once said, "Those who believe in me will live forever," we might think, well, you know what, that's kind of figurative. He really means that, you know, those who follow him will be such good people that people remember them. Right? But when Jesus says it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, then you start to think, wait a minute. No, this has got to be what it actually says. Okay? And it's the same thing here. The exaggerated language describing the king goes so far that you really get the sense that there's something more. And the church, and actually before the church, Jewish scholars, even before Jesus, came to the conclusion that in these psalms, in the real earthly king, the inspired poet is seeing the reflection of a greater coming Messiah king, for whom such language will not be an exaggeration, but will be literally true. It is untrue, but polite, to say to a king, "O king, live forever." Or, "Your rule extends to the ends of the earth." And the king likes it, even though he says, well, not quite. But that well-meaning untruth, that appropriate flattery, becomes literally true when you see the psalm addressed through the historical king to the greater, later, perfect king, who really will live forever and really will reign over all the earth. Now, this exaggerated figurative language becoming literally true when reapplied to the eternal king finds its supreme example in verse 6 that I already referred to. This is where the king appears to be addressed as God in the line, Your throne, O God, will last forever and ever. In the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, which is possibly drawing on an interpretive tradition that predates Jesus, okay? He specifically quotes that line, your God, your throne, O God, as God speaking to the Messiah. Okay? Now, originally in the psalm, it's the poet speaking to the king. But in Hebrews, which again is probably reflecting a tradition that predates the church, says, no, what this really is God speaking to the Messiah. Hebrews quotes this line specifically as God calling his Messiah king God. Now, to an earthly king, calling him a god was a figurative honor. But the irony here is that when that honorable but untrue title is given to God's real and final king, it turns out to be literally true. God calls his Messiah king God because he is God, the second person in a one God who is so full and complete in himself that there is a rich and fulfilling Father-Son relationship within his oneness. The second thing that jumps out when we read this psalm as messianic is the description of the queen, right? What I've been emphasizing as we've read through it, and specifically the advice given her. In the whole Bible, this is my favorite picture of what it means to be the bride of Christ. In the New Testament, the church, all the people throughout the world and throughout all of history who have been reconciled to God and renewed by his Holy Spirit, producing a union with Jesus Christ, are collectively pictured to be the beautiful, glorious, and cherished bride queen of Christ, the eternal glorious king. But what does that mean? What does it mean to be the bride of Christ? Well, it means to be elevated to his side, to share his reign, and to become not just an object of his rescue, but to become a participant of his glory to his greater glory. Christ takes of his own glory and he lays it on the church, transforming us to reflect him. And then when we stand at his side, clothed in his glory, that reflected glory reflects back on him, making his glory even more glorious. Prince William is a good-looking guy, I guess. But he looks really good with Catherine at his side. When we looked at Ephesians last year, we saw that God's plan was actually to reveal Christ's glory through the church. What Christ has done for us and in us actually reveals his glory, makes an unseen glory seen. But it's not what we do. It's not our glory. We do not and cannot and never will bring anything to the table. We can't help Christ out. We can't say, hey, you know what, Jesus, nice ring, but I got a better one here for you. Right? The beauty is his that he gives us. The white garments of purity and goodness are his that he gives us. The good works bringing about God's will in the world and making God's goodness visible are his that he gives us. It is all from him and reflects back on him, not on us. But it's not without us playing the role that he has honored us with. And so, what is the proper response from us? To be given such a glorious role, to be given such an honor, to be elevated to such privilege. How do we respond? Forget your people and your father's house, and be devoted to your new husband, King and Lord. Now, I'm a dad. Don't take that too literally, right? This is not about literally forgetting your family. It's not that when you're born again, God cuts off your family and puts you in the church, and that's your new family. And because that's the real family, then you're just, you got to poo-poo your earthly family. That's out there. Love, honor, visit your dad, buy him tools. Perhaps an 8-inch long bed jointer. But the real point, right? We profess that we have repented of our old way of life, the way of seeking our own will and seeking the things that we think will be good for us. We profess that we have left that behind and that we have turned in faith to Christ, meaning that we choose to obey him and we seek the things that are his will and we trust his plans for what is good for us. So if we profess that we have made that change, don't live halfway between the two lives. Don't live halfway between your father's house and your Lord's house. Don't live in the new kingdom pining for the ways of your youth. The young queen can devote herself to her new life and find fulfillment, honor, and blessing. Or she can mourn the things left behind. Try to bring as much of it with her as she can into her new life and only end up ruining the new life of honor, privilege, and glory that has been given to her. Having been chosen, having been called by God to unite ourselves with Christ and bring glory to him by honoring him, seeking the furtherance of his kingdom, we have been given an unimaginable honor. We have been given nothing short of sharing Christ's inheritance of God's glory. What will compare with that? This is the pearl of great price. This is the high calling. This is worth everything. Appreciate it. Pursue it. Give yourself entirely to this role that you have been honored with, to the greater glory of God in Jesus Christ. Amen.